I'm Meredith.
And I'm Kristen.
Welcome to The Writer Story. It is November and it's gotten
chilly.
And
I believe the rain outside may turn to freezing rain before we're done here.
Lovely.
Yeah. But we are inside, cozy. It's good writing weather.
Yes. No, it definitely is. It's a lot easier to focus if you're not distracted by wanting to go for a walk or something in the evening. But I also feel like I sometimes feel a little like a bear. I want to hibernate. So
yeah,
that's a little hard sometimes.
Yes, this is the time for comfort food and fluffy blankets and
good books, and all that stuff. Yes. And sounds like we've both had a productive month. I'm in first draft mode and you're in revise mode, so that's a very different mode, but
that's right. But we are sharing in common this interest, focus, inclusion of loosely political but contemporary issues that have bubbled up. In my case, I didn't intend it at all. That is, my protagonist's has to deal with an addiction in her family, and it's specifically an opioid addiction. And I did not set out to include that. That was not at all what I thought I was going to be writing. And because it only becomes clear toward the end of the book, it isn't the focus of the book, but still, I've found that I'm needing to learn a lot about that. And of course, that's a big deal these days. And you, Meredith, are also dealing with some big stuff in your book.
Yeah, and I think I stepped into it with much more intention, I think. But it's something that I've been thinking a lot about in our current political climate. Sort of, what is middle ground? Is it possible to have a middle ground? And then also thinking a lot about guns. And I think this is, you know, something as any parent does when they send their kid off to school, you kind of have a lot of anxiety about it because, you know, so many schools have been attacked. And, you know, and so what I basically am thinking about is sort of, can two people, you know, have any kind of relationship, friendship, find middle ground when one is completely, you know, pro gun control and one is very anti gun control. And so I think it's just sort of been an interesting thing. I think there's so much happening with our political climate where people can't even talk, or they just are attacking each other as opposed to sort of trying to understand where someone is coming from. Yeah, I mean, I just think that there's an absurdity that certain things have gone to so that we can't even have a discussion.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, does anyone need a repeating rifle, really, to go hunt? I mean, what is it that you need to be a hunter? You know, what is it that you need to feel like you're protecting your family or whatever and that kind of stuff?
And exactly. And it may not be a dozen assault rifles.
Yeah.
But coming back to writing and guns in this case, it seems like stories, novels in particular, allow an opportunity to vicariously participate in conversation. You know, reading fiction is an act of empathy, right? Wherein the reader puts on the experience of the protagonist. If you're really into a book, so to speak, you're really kind of inhabiting the experience of this character, which is a radically empathetic act. And so what a wonderful medium for exploring, and not just exploring, but actually enlivening or bringing alive the space of conversation across divide.
Yeah.
So good for you.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, and I since I'm in first draft mode, I and cannot confidently say that I'm doing it particularly well at this point, as I muddle through my plot. But I think I'm finding it very interesting because I don't think I've ever tried to do much with politics before, except for a draft of a book that was about real estate in New York, which I just don't think is quite as. So, but you know, I think it's challenging. It's challenging to understand a different point of view. I mean, perhaps this is something, you know, we all learn to do in debate or whatever. You have to argue someone else's point of view and see what the world must be like from there. So that's sort of my, and I think coming from it, from the idea that these are two very damaged people, that one has, is dealing with her fear by wanting to ban all guns, and the other person is dealing with his fear of being, you know, a military veteran by surrounding himself with guns to make himself feel safer. And so I think when it comes down to safety, I feel like they both become very, very sympathetic characters to me because, you know, and then we also, as writers, we play with the sensibilities of our reader by making someone more or less sympathetic. You know, it's the whole like kick the dog scene, you know, whatever. It's like, oh, guess who the, you know,
villain is. But when done well, a reader can see the point of view and understand the motivations of somebody who represents something they may not share.
Right.
Otherwise.
Right.
And I think that's really powerful.
And we've talked about flawed characters before. Yeah. And obviously you just have
taking
a flawed
it to another level.
Character and having a parent who is an addict. And I imagine trying to understand where they're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, what's the, what are they, still a good parent in some way? Or are they, you know, are they...
Yeah, it's been really interesting to write because, again, I didn't set out to do that, but I think it's been there from the very beginning. But because my protagonist is 12 and the story is in the present tense and first person, readers only know as much as she does, or they only see what she sees and hear what she hears. And they witness the events through her eyes. So although a reader may arrive at that conclusion, may see that that's what's going on ahead of her, it's not spelled out. And her experiences are not limited to that either, which I think is true for any person anyway. That is that their life is bigger than any one thing, as big as that thing may even be. But again, she doesn't know that he has this addiction until late in the book. And readers don't actually meet him until late in the book. And I'm as we talk, I think, should I really be saying all this? Because it's a little bit of a reveal.
Right. Well, I do wonder though, and I did read an earlier draft, which is not at all like your current draft, I feel like children do know.
Yeah.
I
think they know a whole lot more than adults think. But then sometimes I think the knowing has different angles and edges than adult knowing of the same thing. So one of the things that I have been doing is just learning a lot more about what it's like for kids who have parents with an opioid addiction in particular, but addiction in general. And I have to say, Sesame Street is incredible. I learned that they have a new character whose parents are addicts. And the way they explore it is so beautifully Sesame Street with its looks things in the eye, but isn't gratuitous.
Mm-hmm.
And there's great sensitivity, but honesty as well. That at least that's my impression. Others may take a different perspective, but it's been interesting to see what they've done in talking with kids about addiction.
Yeah.
And then of course I've used some of the resources that are so easily available online for parents of parents who are addicts for their children. Like at what age, how do you talk to kids about this? At what age might they know? And of course, it's a wide variability. But anyway, it has actually affected some of the ways I'm shaping the ending.
Mm-hmm.
The ending is changing a little bit in light of wanting things for my character that I think are fair for her.
Yeah, we talked about probably research before, and that's always a challenge to know when to research and when researching derails your writing process.
Yes, and when to end the research. Yeah.
I err on the side of late, which is sometimes a problem because you've already solidified quite a few things and now you have to backpedal and say, uh-oh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that can be quite a challenge.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to be sure I don't do here is for my character to compromise her dreams to take care of her parents, unless that is revealed to be problematic. Does that make sense? I don't want to communicate to kids it's a good idea that you need to take care of your parents who are addicts and you should forfeit your dreams. So I don't want that to be a message. And again, I don't know that I want to reveal all of what happens, and maybe I've given away too much already, but and maybe it doesn't matter. Anyway, it's been an interesting process. And then there's just the mechanics of revision that I've been in deeply and engrossed and meshed in. And I go back and forth on what direction I want things to take. And I forget which version has which ones after a while.
Well, let's bring in our guest tonight.
We're so excited to have Padma Venkatraman, who was on a panel that I had the honor of moderating at the James Ruhr Writers Conference. She is an amazing writer for young readers, so it'll be just terrific to have her chat with us today.
Awesome. Let's give her a call. Well, hello.
We are so happy to have Padma Venkatraman with us today. As I mentioned, Padma was on a panel that I moderated at the James Ruhr Writers Conference. It was a wonderful opportunity to become acquainted with some of her work. She's the author of several books, books of young adult fiction, and a middle grade novel, most recently, titled The Bridge Home. We'll talk a bit about that and how you came to writing, Padma, if you're game. And anyway, we're just thrilled to have you here. So thank you.
Thank you so much.
So, Padma, you have a quite interesting background in the scientific world. Before you even started writing, so Padma is a scientist of oceanography, yeah?
Yes, indeed.
And were you writing along the way, or how did that happen?
It's an excellent question, and I did want to say, but then I held back because I wasn't sure. That it's just an absolute joy and a delight to talk to you, both of you. And it was lovely to meet you at the James River Writers Conference. So thank you for having me. And, you know, I started writing. I can't remember a time when I actually started writing. I know that sounds very odd, but I believe my mother says that I would dictate poetry to her at the age of 4.
Oh.
Apparently extremely picky about my line breaks, which she found quite astonishing, because she said, you know, the concept of a line, and plus I would be too tired to write, so I would dictate to her, but I would say, did you stop the line there? So, you know, these things that one worries about so much in, when one becomes an adult, I think about my line breaks all the time now, but apparently then it was all just crystal clear to me. So I don't remember a time that I wasn't a writer, in the sense that I always think and I always say that we're writers because we write, not because we get published, not because we get accolades, but because we write.
Yeah.
And to me, that's always been the way that I define myself, that it's been sort of an intrinsic part of who I am, and the way that I think express myself and communicate. I, you know, it's the most important form of communication for me, perhaps.
Wow, that is so terrific. Yeah, I also dictated to my mother before I could read.
Wow.
And I also would, my mother even saved some of these. I would write what I thought was cursive, but of course I couldn't actually write, and I would fill pages. And I think that's so interesting, because if books are such a precious thing to you and you want to create your own from such an early age, I think it really is a natural process.
It is. Yeah. And so my first publication was actually when I was about 12 years old. I sent a poem off to Poetry Quarterly, and it's the Delhi London Poetry Quarterly, which is quite a prestigious journal, actually. And they published my poem. With a little saying that I was a young author, but, you know, nevertheless, they did. And that was, I think, a big boost for me. So
I had that.
And then, you know, after that, there was a long dry spell, and I didn't even submit or anything, but I would always write, and then I would write science. For a long time, I wrote science for lay people.
Oh, yeah.
In magazines, for instance, or in newspapers, or sometimes kids' magazines. So that was sort of one extra thing that I did, and a way that I kept in touch with the slightly more creative side of myself when I was in graduate school for oceanography. And I always read, and I think that to me is just, you know, so important, because when you read, you're just nourishing yourself, I think, as a writer, and that is immense. It's just, to me, I see, you know, I see writers sometimes who ask whether they should read, and they worry that they'll be influenced. And I think to myself, my goodness, you know, a musician never says, should I listen to music? Never says, you know, should I walk into the museum and look at other people's art? You know, artists actually will sit there copying the great masters, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I once heard a panel, and it was with a lot of best-selling authors, and they talked about how they wrote, they didn't have time to read. And I remember watching them and thinking, well, I don't think I want to be a New York Times best-selling author if I don't have time to read. Like, there's so much pleasure in that.
Yeah. Yeah. And have you always been reading across genres, Padma?
Yes, yes. So I read very widely. I like poetry, not all poetry, obviously, but I love poems. I, you know, read books for adults. I read books for kids. I read nonfiction. And because of that, in a way, I don't, you know, sometimes if you question me, I may not know maybe in depth any particular genre, but I read across all the time.
Yeah. And so you started with poetry, and did you think that you were going to be strictly a poet, or did, again, you feel sort of like your reading that you would write across genres too?
I didn't. I did originally think of myself as a poet, and, you know, I thought of myself actually as a poet and a nonfiction
Wow, yeah.
Because I was always interested in science and mathematics. And, you know, it was a sort of turning point in my life. And I was in England at the time in the process of becoming an American citizen. And I was thinking a lot about really, you know, violence and nonviolence and what it meant to me. And then suddenly my grand uncle, who had participated in the Second World War on the Allied side, was one of the people who became part of what grew to be the world's largest all-volunteer force in the Second World War, which was from the British Indian Army. Yeah, and very few people know that. And at one point it was. But anyways, he became sort of a character in my mind, and this story started to take shape. And then, of course, magical things happen when you write. And when I started to type, I couldn't hear his voice as clearly as I could hear my mother's voice. And I saw this image of this girl standing at the foot of a staircase that she was not allowed to climb just because of her gender. Because in the house in which she lived, men lived upstairs where the library was, and women stayed downstairs where the kitchen was.
Uh-huh.
And not allowed to climb the stairs to get books out of the library.
Oh, wow.
And that is that the genesis then of your book? The title is Climbing the Stairs?
Absolutely.
Yes.
It works both metaphorically and literally, and that was my first novel. And I think, you know, once you have that behind you, once you have finished a novel,
yeah,
then you know you can do it again.
Yeah. Well, it must have been a courageous thing to go from that to, I think about A Time to Dance, which is a novel in verse. So, you, right?
Or yes. So actually from that, I went to Island's End, which is another.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's also a prose novel, but it's sort of very lush, rich, evocative prose. And
yeah,
then to go from that to A Time to Dance, which is sort of lean, spare verse. It's interesting because I did say I always was a poet and I saw myself as a poet. And yet by the time I came to A Time to Dance, I had this sort of imposter syndrome. You know, Padma Venkatraman, here you are. You've studied thermodynamics and entropy and things like that. What are you doing writing all? And then now you want to write poetry. And Richard Blanco, who was President Obama's inaugural poet.
Yeah.
Yes, a wonderful man. And, you know, first gay poet, the first Cuban poet to be an inaugural poet. Anyway, wonderful person. He, Cuban-American. Anyway, he was, you know, very encouraging. So I sat in on one of his workshops at the University of Rhode Island. And, you know, some of my other colleagues here at the University of Rhode Island who are writers as well, Peter Covino, Mary Capello, they all helped me in the sense that at least they, you know, they were supportive of my being a writer. And that, I think, helped. And then, of course, I read a lot of poems and I sat in on a graduate class in writing, and all of that, I think, helped me. I sat in sort of, you know, didn't do any of the work, but at least I listened a little bit. And I think all of those things helped me to give myself permission to write A Time to Dance. And obviously A Time to Dance, the theme of A Time to Dance, which is ultimately a young girl's spiritual awakening as seen through the Hindu lens. It's the first novel to do that, you know, to look at a young girl's spiritual awakening through the Hindu lens. And I think whenever you talk about spirituality, if you don't want to write a sermon, which I don't think is our job as novelists or poets.
Yeah.
You know, if you don't want to preach, then you need the white space, especially if you don't want to beat someone over the head with any particular religion. Then, you know, that white space helps so much, and a verse allows for that white space. And also the theme of dance is so rhythmic. And so I think the dance rhythms also come out accentuated in a verse novel. So I think A Time to Dance just had to be a novel in verse. And luckily, I gathered enough courage to do it that way.
Yeah, well, it's a beautiful novel. I had the pleasure of reading that. And then, of course, The Bridge Home, this wonderful newest novel of yours for middle grade readers in particular, which has garnered such terrific, well, all of your books have earned wonderful critical reviews. Now, The Bridge Home has won how many stars now? Star reviews?
Thank you. I think now it's up to 8, which is fantastic.
Wow, that is amazing. And was selected as the Global Read Aloud Book 2019. I understand you're just finishing that kind of tenure of engagement, right, with kids across the world?
Yes, it was the most amazing honor ever. I mean, I'm delighted. And I should say with the stars, it's, you know, 3 of them were for the audio, which I read myself, which was a lot of fun.
That's great.
I don't know. Actually, I'm not sure I would call it fun. I think I used the words exhilarating and exhausting when they asked me, and I think that was perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, because, you know, you actually work with a director. It's sort of an acting thing, so it was a wonderful experience. Anyway, I got off track a little bit, but I am delighted, and the Global Read Aloud is the most amazing experience because, you know, it means that you can connect with children across the planet, and to be able to do that, to be able to interact with them, to answer their questions, to just connect in that way and so deeply over a book is wonderful. It's just, it compares to nothing else.
Well, that is great. It is such a gift, the book itself, the story of these kids in India who are orphans, essentially have such challenging circumstances and face some really, really horrific circumstances, but you handle it with such grace, and yet you still feel they're real characters. I'm wondering what were some of the ways kids responded to that may have surprised you or especially thrilled you? It seems like a book that, despite the particularity of its characters, has some real universal oomph.
I think I've been amazed and you know, incredibly humbled. The most important thing, I think, for me that ever happened through The Bridge Home is that several children and 2 adults have actually taken strength from the book, or it's been one small step in their moving toward a safer place in their lives. And that is incredible to me. That is immense. That's a gift beyond any that I can ever imagine or even begin to comprehend. Just, and I always say, you know, if I died tomorrow, it wouldn't have been in vain because my life touched someone else's life for the better.
Yeah, that is great. So for our listeners, would you talk a little bit about how you came to write the book?
Certainly. And I should also say, actually, while we're on the topic of reader responses, that luckily, young people have just been wonderful. I mean, they love the book, and it is, you know, I don't hold back from being very honest with my readers. It's not a fairy tale. And one lovely young person said, actually, it's like The Boxcar Kids, only much better and much real.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, they know even at a very young age if you're lying to them. And you know, I have had, I did have teachers who switched and said that my book was too powerful and all of that. And it was funny because I think too powerful is wonderful. It's one of the most powerful books I've ever read is a compliment to me. But I think it is intense. It looks to me like teachers and adults worry more about the intensity that children are able to deal with that. They cry, but they also laugh. Every child that has cried in the book has also laughed with the characters, and that to me is immense, you know. And I think that was significant because the book is about homeless children who experienced dire poverty in India. And if you laugh with a character, then you're on equal plane with that character. And I wanted my readers to see these children just the way they did, as children who were their friends, who could be their friends in real life. Mm. I never wanted sympathy, and no child has given those characters sympathy. They have elicited the response that I wanted, which was empathy. And to me, to create that, just a little more empathy or compassion in the world is the most amazing thing. And I think this book has been able to do that through the characters. And I think that's because the characters are based on real people.
Oh, that's so interesting. So I have a quick question for you. Did you set out to write for children, or was it just the stories that you were compelled to tell that ended up being for children?
The first novel, Climbing the Stairs, when I wrote that, I didn't, because it could have been anything. But I was teaching at a school in England at that time, and so I wanted it to be accessible for young people. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't really sure, and that's why I think I was looking at it. And then when I discovered what a young adult novel was, which I have to say I didn't really know before that, I thought, well, I can try it as a young adult novel, and then that way maybe adults will read it and young people will read it too. And so that's what I did with Climbing the Stairs. And then after that, my other novels just sort of fell into that. I loved that. I loved writing young adult novels. And then with my daughter wanting to read a novel, I decided that with The Bridge Home, I would do it as a middle grade.
Oh.
So that it would be accessible for her. And, you know, the first draft had a lot of on-screen violence, which is now off-screen, but it was such a hard job to make sure that the novel had the same emotional impact, because I wanted adults to cry when they read the novel, which they do, thank God, in droves. But I wanted that to happen, and yet I wanted it to be a book that a child could pick up and that a child would not have to have to be forced to see more than they wanted to, let's just say.
Yeah. You do a beautiful job with that. As an adult reader of the novel, I knew some of what was happening.
Right.
But I didn't have to have it spelled out. Even as an adult reader, it was sort of a relief too, not to. It made it it made it easier also to not feel such pity for them.
Right.
Though I did feel, you know, so sorry that their lives had the challenges that they did, that they had to face the kinds of things they did. They lived under the circumstances they did. But the children were resilient and, as you said, you know, funny at times and resourceful. You'd strike a really nice balance there. Now, you mentioned that you based them on real people. Can you tell us a little bit about how that came to be?
Certainly. So I was born into a very wealthy family in India, but when I was about 8, my parents separated. And after that, my mother and I were in economic situations that were quite challenging, incredibly challenging. And she had nothing at all in the bank, actually, when she started. And, you know, I think she was 40-something when she had to start over. And she started with a negative bank balance because she was actually left with some debt. But she was determined that she would do everything on her own and independently of anyone else. So she was very strong in that regard. And she worked incredibly hard to make sure there was a roof over our heads and food on the table. But when she was doing that, she also somehow managed to keep up with the volunteer work that she'd started, I assume, because, once upon a time, she was this wealthy woman who could do volunteer work as a charitable enterprise if she wanted, and she kept that up.
Wow.
So I met children whom I probably would not have met if it hadn't been for that circumstance. And those kids had experienced poverty like nothing on earth. I mean, you know, having lived in this country for so long, sometimes I say I grew up poor, but my goodness, yeah. When I was in India, that was not poor, you know?
Yeah.
What I experienced was not. There was just poor beyond imagining. And those children, but they were wonderful. Some of the kids, the ones that I made friends with, were extremely independent. They were very brave. They certainly didn't want anybody's pity, mm-hmm. least for mine. And I think that was what helped me capture the character, the same sort of spirit in the characters, the kids, the laughter that they managed to somehow squeeze out of even circumstances that are just horrific.
Mm-hmm. Oh. Yeah. And how old were you when you met those kids? Were you a little kid then, same age as them or not?
I was. So, you know, yeah. Some of them were older than me, some of them were a little younger than me, and some of them I got better than others. And, you know, three of them sort of stood out. But I'd say, you know, I can't remember, probably between the ages of, I mean, I'm assuming they met them, but I remember more when I was around, what to say, 12 or so, when one of the girls, Indra, told me the story that I drew upon or inspired. I wouldn't say drew upon, but that really inspired the Bridge Home, sort of the outline of the novel in the most basic sense, if you will.
Yeah.
So are you continuing to write for middle grade or YA at your next book? I'm guessing there's another one that you're working on.
I hope so. I mean, send me your blessings and hopefully there'll be plenty more.
Yes.
But yeah, so I would like to write across the board. I would love to write more middle grade. I'd love to write some more YA. And I'd love to write a novel for adults as well someday that brings in my science and my writing. So
yeah, so that'd be great.
Yeah.
Well, we know that, speaking of kids, you have a little one whose bedtime is coming up and we don't want to keep her up too late, but we've been so happy to have you visit with us, Padma.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It was my pleasure.
Well, that was really great to talk to her. I'm so glad you met her at James River Writers.
Me too. And there's so much more we could talk about. You know, she's lived in 5 countries. I think about how, you know, our experiences inform the ways that we write as well as the things we write about. And we didn't get a chance. I mean, there's just so many more things to talk about.
Oh, I know. And the whole notion of balancing, I'm sure, a very successful and rigorous career in science,
right,
with writing and with a family, and
yes,
you know, more I think things. Yeah, just so much to talk about, but it was,
maybe
just,
we can have her back.
Yeah, but it was really lovely. I think it was interesting because it sounded like she had some real insights into some of the things that you've been thinking about and I've been thinking about as well.
I found it helpful to have her note that novels that try to preach tend to kind of fall flat.
Yeah.
And I think about the novel that you're working on now with gun control as a huge issue. You could get on a soapbox.
Yeah.
And telling a story.
But I don't know. I think you would lose people that way.
Yeah. And I know you won't, because you're really good.
Well, I don't want to, but I think that, yeah, I think you can gloss over things, or you can try to convince somebody of something.
Yes.
And show your hand, perhaps.
Yeah, when what you need to do is tell a good story.
I mean, it just kind of reminds me of something, you know, like books we read from our childhood that perhaps, you know, made us love animals more or something. But at no point did anyone say, an animal is worth just as much as a human being, right? That would be preaching at you.
Right.
Instead, you would get to care about these characters, and then you would you'd be afraid something would happen to the, you know what I mean? So
in
I think
the
that
same sorts of ways, yes.
That, so. The kind of thing where, and I thought what was very interesting is she talked about sort of what kids can handle.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And
how adults are more nervous about what they can take than what the kids can actually manage.
Oh, I mean, when I think about all the books that adults ban.
Yeah.
Because they're considered very dangerous for children. I think it's so compelling because I don't feel that as a child I was particularly easily swayed. I feel like I read very widely, but it wasn't like, oh, now I'm going to go murder someone because I read a murder mystery. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like, I think that people have a tendency to think that children are being molded. And yes, they are in many ways, but they're being sort of, they're being influenced by everything around them.
Yeah. And I also think books that tackle challenging issues or use language that makes you uncomfortable can be sort of like inoculating you. When done well, they give you strength in the face of similar things.
But I also remember as a child, you know, reading David Copperfield before perhaps, you know, I was ready. And then reading it again and saying, oh, I read this book, and then having no memory of large swaths of it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Also being quite disturbed by some of the things that happened and realizing that as a child, when I didn't understand something mm-hmm. or it was too challenging, that I probably glossed over it.
Yeah.
And it didn't really sink in.
Yeah. Yeah. It makes me wonder, I've never thought about this before, but if there's a different effect if you take a story in from a visual medium like television or movies versus books. That I feel the same way. Like, I read, like you, widely as a kid. And there weren't that many children's books when I was a kid. I read books that would have been kind of for adults. Maybe someone would be considered young adults. But when I was still a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, I think if there were really difficult or uncomfortable places that I may have skipped over otherwise.
Or read it, but not really understood what you were reading, and so it didn't really sink in. Or...
Yeah, not in damaging ways. I'm damaged by many other things, but we don't. That's
for another
may not
podcast.
Be the place.
Yeah.
Tune in next week. No, but I think about by comparison, watching The Wizard of Oz and those dang on monkeys. That's
scarred for life.
Scarred for life. Yeah. You couldn't get away from them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Literally in your face.
Literally in your face. Yeah. No, I think it's just compelling. And I do think, you know, it's important to hear from someone who's very successful, you know, YA and middle grade author that middle grade and YA have gotten a lot darker than possibly people remember from their childhood of, you know, Sweet Valley High and, you know,
Nancy Drew, right.
Part 10 or whatever. And I think Heidi can be dark too, but, and a lot of things are acceptable in YA now and encouraged.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wouldn't be shocked if there's agents out there that are saying, send us your transgender story.
Oh, yes.
Encouraging, you know, just anything that people would say, well, why would, children want to read. Children want to read these stories or books, you know, where parents are addicted. And that's something that they feel is really necessary if there's a kid dealing with that or if they've got classmates or if it's, that might be something they would even be compelled to, you know, they'd be compelled to read about, to learn more, to find out more, to find out.
Yeah. You know? Just to hear how someone,
or what are the, what are,
someone
yeah,
else goes
it's a healing story.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think human, you know, we all are trying to learn as, you know, as children, we are trying to learn about what it means to be an adult, what it means to be a human being and what, you know, and I think that for me, books were really important to me.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And just managing things, seeing how someone else managed a similar situation as I might have seen or felt. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, keep revising.
And keep writing.
I'm using the energy from NaNoWriMo to keep me writing every day, although I never have written 50,000 words in a month, and I probably never will. that's okay.
But if you're doing it, carry on. If I manage 30,000
this month, I will be ecstatic.
Yes.
And we'll feel that I can go into December and write the at last 10 to 20 with great happiness.
Yes.
So.
You bet.
All right, Will. We shall reconvene either next month or in the new year and continue to talk about writing.
Sounds great.
Thanks so much for joining us.